My name's Mitzi. I'm an alcoholic. Me speaking on a PA system's redundant, I'll tell you. Here's my... I need to say probably in my entire sobriety, I was the most serene and balanced and centered as I could possibly be this weekend. And I had no fear about speaking because I thought, what, you know...
You want me to pull that back?
Why? Now you've disrupted my continuity. Anyway, I didn't have any fear. I thought, what, can I ruin your sobriety? Can I take away years? No, I can't really affect you. And I got in the car, and someone who shall remain nameless, although I would love to break their anonymity tonight, gave me instructions how to get here. Now, I thought I knew how to get here, but I, because I'm on a new path, I said, I'm going to listen to them. I'm going to follow their instructions. This is my new way, even though I know I'm right. So I meticulously followed their instructions, and literally, I think I left my house at 6 o'clock. I live in Antelope. I got here at 7:58, frenzied, harried. So I'm not spiritually centered, but I am here, dressed. Okay. I just want to tell you before I speak, somebody has to tell me when 10 minutes are up. I tend to run off at the mouth. Thank you. So I mean, I get to start for 10 minutes now? I'm teasing. Anyway, I was part of the group that started the roll off to recovery meeting, and I don't remember why. I remember I had very few days of sobriety, and I was very confused for about 2 years. But I want to talk about the first time I got drunk and the last time I got drunk. And in that period, there were 22 years. And looking back, I realized that I literally did do the same thing over and over. And I was of the ilk that I didn't care if I got different results. But the first time I got drunk, I was 18 years old. And I was a freshman in college. And I got drunk because everybody else was getting drunk. I went to a fraternity party. I was with an assistant professor of mine that I had meticulously stalked for about 3 months. And this is very integral to my story. I got very sick behind feeling that I needed something. It was usually a man to make me feel better, worse, indifferent. You know, you fill in the blank. But I had stalked this man, and finally he acquiesced. And he took me to this fraternity party. And I was very nervous, and there was beer there, and I drank a lot of it. And I remember drinking it. It was a return to the womb party. This is very important because there were parachutes all over this fraternity house, and it was very hot and close in there because of the parachutes. There was no air. And I kept drinking this beer. I was hot. And some time that night I passed out, and I woke up, and I remember, I mean, this was 30 years ago, I hate to tell you, but it was 30 years ago in September. And I remember seeing the color of the carpet, and I remember seeing my underpanties lying on this carpet. And I just felt this jolt of fear because I knew they shouldn't be there. And I said to this guy, what's going on? What happened? And he said, well, you know, we had sex. And I said, but I'm a virgin. And he said, not anymore. And that dynamic, the stalking, the drinking into oblivion, the getting abused, and I need to say I stopped drinking beer, you see, after that night. I said, well, beer is the problem. Beer will never pass my lips. But I continued seeing this guy for 3 years, who's now a psychologist in Los Angeles. Just let me share that with you. But that was what I did for 22 years. I stalked, you know, just these arbitrary people that looked like I thought people should look. I would stalk them. I would not take no for an answer. I would have to continue to stay drunk so I couldn't feel any of the shame and degradation that went along with that kind of behavior. And I did that for 22 years. And I traveled to do it. I went back and forth across the country 3 times. I left houses, I left men, I left pets, and I say that because I'm a pet lover, Hector. And, you know, I mean, I don't have children, and that they were my children. I left them at a moment's notice. My suitcase was ready. But I need to talk faster. Anyway, I did that, and I did that, and I did that, and I continued to drink, and I continued to search, and I continued to change men and change booze and change geographical locations, change my hair, change my makeup, change what I wore, because I was totally focused on what is out here. And I never, ever considered that there was something wrong with me spiritually. I didn't consider myself a spiritual being. Anyway, what liquor did for me was take away my will to live. And unfortunately, it took many years, but eventually it did take away my will to live. And on June 11th, 1989, at 6:36 in the morning, I made the alcoholic decision that I was done. And I didn't say, I'm done, I'm going to now seek a better way of living. I said, I'm done living. And I made what I considered a valiant attempt to die, and didn't. And I ended up in a hospital, emergency room, psych center, the whole nine yards, and they threw me here in Sacramento at New Dawn Recovery Home. And you know, when I got here, I was so willing to do whatever you said for me to do, because I was 40 years old when I got sober, and I was pretty smart. And I felt like I had really altered every variable I could in my life to be okay with who I was. And I was never, ever okay. I couldn't make my hair any cuter. I couldn't get a cuter guy, a better car. I couldn't change any of that. I had done it. And nothing worked. And the alcohol helped me to continue to function in that capacity. And today I think I needed to do that. And the best thing that's ever happened to me in my life was my bottom. I thank God for that bottom. I really do. Because I am 100% convinced that I cannot drink. That alcohol will not solve any problem. Although I told Pat when I got here, a martini would have been very good after my getting lost tonight. But, you know, I do know it does not solve my problems. It creates intense despair and a desire to die. And thank God I got to play with that for about 7 years before I got sober. So I'm pretty clear, you know, I'm pretty clear. Because, you know, I sponsor a lot of women, and I used to fight with them. Got to stay sober, and they just weren't clear. And I know today I can't force that upon somebody. They need to go where I went. So I got here, I was very, very, very willing. And I just told Hector, he was admiring my big book cover. And I said, this book cost me $30,000. Which I still pay off today. Because that's, when I got into the treatment center, they gave me a big book, they gave me a 12-12, they gave me a 24-hour, whatever it's called, it's a little tiny black thing, 24 hours, something. And then they charged me, they told me to go to AA, take care, and $30,000, thank you. Well, let me save you some money, okay? This is what I was told, and I'm going to tell you, this is my truth. I do this, and I do this because I'm desperate. They told me I needed to go to a meeting every day. And for the first 2 years, I went to 8 meetings a week. So I went to 2 on Saturday. I went to every day. This now, I go to three, I was going to say three or four a week. That would be a lie. I go to three a week. I got a sponsor, which I still have, and I suggest that anybody that doesn't have a sponsor get one tonight, because any person without a sponsor has a sponsee for a fool. I suggest, it was told to me for $30,000 that I work these steps. You know, and today I live the steps, and they are work. But I do live the steps. Sponsor, meetings, steps. And I also have needed to do other 12-step programs. I go to Al-Anon. I don't know if we need to erase that. But I do. I mean, I need to let you be who you are. I am the most controlling person in the entire world. And that's the kind of stuff that gets me drunk. I'm also, you know, when I was out there drinking and looking to be okay, the reason I needed outside, because I had nothing inside. And, you know, the 12 steps says we had a spiritual awakening. It didn't say we had a spiritual rebirth or spirituality sprung. An awakening connotes that there was some dormancy in there. And I do believe I was always a spirited person. So my spirit has become awakened. And it grows and grows and grows the more work I do. And because I have gotten and lived the promises in this program, I want more. I mean, that's my favorite word. More is my favorite word. No is my least favorite word. And I feel the same way with my program. And I will continue to work on a daily basis. And it has been work for me because I am an alcoholic. It is very difficult for me to be loving and vulnerable and who I am because I want you to love me. I really do. And I will do anything. I used to do anything. And today I can be myself and some people love me and some don't. And I can let them not and be okay. I'm done. However, wait a minute. I brought my book for a reason. I actually brought my book because it looks like I know something about the big book, but I do want to read something. Hector brought his book too. I want to read you my favorite two paragraphs. And it says, it's on the last page of the book. I can find it easily. It says, our book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize we know only a little. God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. Ask him in your morning meditation what you can do each day for the man who is still sick. Notice it says man. The answers will come if your own house is in order. But obviously you cannot transmit something you haven't got. See to it that your relationship with him is right. And great events will come to pass for you and countless others. This is a great fact for us. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you until then. Thank you.
Thanks, Mitzi. Now I would like to introduce our main speaker from Hector E. from Los Angeles. I had the pleasure of picking him up at the airport and got a chance to know him, and I know you people. He hasn't been to Sacramento before, so please give him a warm Sacramento welcome.
Hello, everybody. My name is Hector Elias, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Hector.
And I thought she gave a wonderful pitch. Yeah. I laughed when she said pets because I had two pets, two cats. Jake and Lucy. So when she said abandon your pet, I said, I don't think so. And actually the name of my group comes from the paragraph she just read. It says, This is the great fact for us. The great fact is the name of my group in LA. So I want to thank Terry for asking me to speak. It's always a great honor to speak in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and sometimes it's a pleasure. I don't know, you know, they book you in advance months and months, and sometimes you go to speak, you know, and it's, oh God, I'm depressed, you know what I mean? I didn't get this and that. But you had to go and do it. And if you want to stay sober, you had to do it. Did you read the sign as you came in? Free mental health depression test. Did they know I was going to speak here today? Is that why they put the sign up there? How did they know? Anyway, whatever I say from the podium is just my experience and my opinion. Unfortunately, I happen to be very opinionated. And I may be wrong, but I'm never in doubt. And one of the wonderful things about Alcoholics Anonymous, we can disagree about many things. As long as we drink and use and work the steps, we stay sober and change. And change is the most difficult thing we do here. Letting go of old ideas. I'm going to start at the very beginning. My father's an Arab, my mother's an Italian, and I was born in Argentina. I'm glad you think it's funny. I think I came out Japanese. They were poor, they were illiterate, they were violent, they dressed badly, and they smelled even worse. You see, we're poor, poor like in Argentina, poor in this country, is middle class all around the world. You don't know it. But, you know, we had dirt floors, no running water, no heat, no bathroom, just an outhouse. And they were very violent. But I didn't know I was an abused child until I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. So here they give you all these problems, you know. I thought everybody, you know, got beaten up and chained to the sewing machine. Mother used to chain me to the sewing machine. It was nothing personal, you know. She also chained my little sister and the dog, you know, nothing personal. And I really disliked my parents very much, and I was very ashamed of my house. So for the first 18 years of my life, I never invited a kid home because I was ashamed of the way we lived. You know, and I was terrified of my parents because my house was like a minefield. They were going to start fighting, and all of a sudden, father would grab a knife in the middle of the night, and we all run outside, you know, in our underwear. We were too poor to have pajamas. So I really disliked my parents very, very much. My mother used to do something else, and I talk about my parents a little bit at the beginning because I'm going to tell you how I dealt with it in sobriety. My mother, you know, used to come at night after we do something mischievous, and I'm not talking about joining a gang or owning it or doing anything, you know, maybe being late from school or something. She said, I'm not going to chase after you. You had to come to sleep. So when I was sound asleep at 1 o'clock in the morning, she would uncover me and beat my ass with a shoe. So I wake up at 1 o'clock in the morning like, what's going on? So for the first 18 years of my life, I slept totally covered because I didn't know what was coming. My father was worse, more violent, but he did it less often. Because my mom always talked against my father, I really, really hated my father. My first dream as a child was not to be a doctor or president of Argentina or a movie star. My first dream as a child was to kill my daddy. What are you going to do, Hector, when you grow up? I'm going to kill my daddy with a dull razor blade. You know, I just... But I saved myself. It seems I had a special star since I was a child. You know, the hand of God was always at hand. And when I was 12 years old, I got into sports. I became an athlete. And I used to come home, drop the books, and go to the gym. And I did judo, and I did basketball. And, you know, my second dream as a child was to be the first white globe trotter. You know what I mean? I just love basketball, you know. But I was too short, and I couldn't jump high. So it was kind of rather difficult. And so at 12, I got out of the house. At 18, I left the house. And when I was 24, I came to America. Oh, by the way, I came here legally, okay? So don't get any funny ideas. If you don't like my pitch, you cannot call immigration, okay? It's too late. And I went to the easiest place for a hick boy like me, you know, to live in New York. And I learned English because when you come here legally, you had to really show the ambassador that you speak English. You had to have some money and a profession. But I couldn't understand a single person in New York because in New York nobody speaks English. You know what I mean? They speak Brooklynese. And I had a great deal of difficulty, and I remember the second day in New York, it snowed 14 inches, and I had never seen snow. And it was about this tall. I absolutely adored it. You know what I mean? I jump on it. I'm a snowman. I threw snowballs. I just absolutely adored it for a day. Anyway, at the beginning it was very difficult, you know, because I couldn't understand people. But I went to school right away. I didn't know I had an accent. And if you think I have an accent now, you should have heard me, you know, 36 years ago. And I remember I went to see this movie with this young lady, and I had been here like for 6 months, right? And I didn't know I had an accent. And the movie was Gina Ravidge and Rock Hudson. And all of a sudden I realized Gina spoke with an accent. She spoke funny. So I turned around to my date and I said, "Boy, she has thick accent." And she says, "Oh, no, no, it's very charming, just like yours." "I have accent?" She says, "Oh, yes, and it's adorable." I went home, and the next day I bought a tape recorder, and caca, 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 did I have an accent? I sounded like Fito Bandido, you know what I mean? God. So I began going to school at night, you know, to learn English, because I felt since I came to this country, it was my duty to speak good English, not for you to understand my Spanish. I'm a Latino. I don't believe bilingual anything. You come here, you learn English. You go to Argentina, you better speak Spanish, or else we shoot you. You know. And you know, I had seen pictures of you and, you know, and American magazines, and I was always in love with America. I'm still in love with America. And I worked real hard, and I saved money, and within a year and a half, I went to Europe, you know, for 4 months, and I visited 9 countries, and I saw all the art in the world, and the most beautiful masterpieces of the culture, and, you know, and I came back, and I began accumulating the things I had seen in, you know, in American magazines. I really fulfilled, you know, the American dream. I had, you know, the furniture from Bloomingdale's, the suits from Brooks Brothers, you know, some hand-cut crystal. And I always felt like a piece of garbage. And I didn't know why. You told me why when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. You told me I was looking for a material solution to a spiritual problem. And you told me nothing that I can see with my eyes can fix my insides. The solution to all my problems is inside of me. It's called the kingdom of God. It's a living spirit of God inside of me. I didn't know this. Since I came from garbage and I consider myself garbage, if I thought, you know, I accumulated all these things, you know, I was going to be okay. And I was always a very lonely person. Always. Because, see, I'm not going to let you know me, because if you know me, you're not going to like me. So I kept the distance. They call alcoholism the disease of loneliness. Loneliness is also described as the love, the fear of love. I'll keep at a distance. And I never liked anything about myself. That's the reason why I began drinking, you know. I remember once I saw an article, I saw that Leonardo da Vinci, who was a genius, has said, "The perfectly proportioned man is 7 times the size of his head." Now, da Vinci was a genius, okay? So I measure my head. This is extra large. According to that, I am supposed to be 7 feet 2 inches tall. Every time I looked in the mirror, I saw this little midget with this huge head, you know. And in those days, it was bigger because I had an afro, you know what I mean? Oh, God. You see my nose? It looks like a bell pepper, right? Well, I had a nose job. I'm the only person I know who looks the same before and after. I went home and my mother didn't realize I had a nose job. I was so pissed. "Ma, made in America, $1,700, you know." She didn't get it. Pissed me off. So anyway, you know, I wanted to be part of America. What I really wanted to be, I'll tell you a secret. It was not a secret, but I'll tell you. What I always really wanted to be was a WASP. That was my dream, to be a WASP, you know what I mean? Oh, to be blonde, you know. And I used to dress in Brooks Brothers suit, you know, the pinstripes, and not the pinstripe, the herringbone, the button-down shirt, the striped tie, and my wingtip shoes. And no matter how hard I tried, you know, I looked like a Mexican yuppie, you know what I mean? I never made it. Because, you know. So, anyway, I wanted to socialize. I wanted to be part of America. And they told me in order to socialize, I had to go to a bar. I never been to a bar, ever. In Argentina, I was an athlete, you know. So, but I want to be part of America. I want to be, you know, where the Americans are. I want to go and socialize. So I dressed in my Brooks Brothers suit, you know, the whole thing. And I'm always a control freak, just very much like Bitsy, you know what I mean? I said, I want to be perfect. I practiced, had to say, whiskey. I said, whiskey, you know, just like in the movies, right? Whiskey. I wanted to be sophisticated, right? So I practiced in the mirror. So I walked into this bar. And I looked around. It was a very elegant bar. All the guys were blonde. They were crew cuts, dark suits, you know, and dark ties. Maybe two or three ladies. They all looked like Mormons. You see, because you had to understand, the only Americans I knew in Argentina were the Mormons missionaries. And they all looked like that. Tall, blonde, with crew cuts, you know, dark suits. They used to come to our little town to try to change us. From unhappy little Catholics to unhappy little Mormons. You know. And they were very nice people. They play great basketball too. The only thing is they cannot play on Sundays. Pissed me off. So I thought it was a Mormon bar, right? So the bartender, who's tall and blonde, come over and goes, you see, English to us is like Spanish to you when you don't know it. It's gibberish, you know. But I was prepared. I said, whiskey, you know. And he insisted. Like I'm saying, whiskey. Now in hindsight, I realized what he was saying. You know, with soda on the rocks, what kind of whiskey? I don't understand English. I kept saying, whiskey, whiskey, whiskey. He got pissed. So he grabbed this bottle with a beak and this little glass, a shot glass. I've never seen a shot glass before. I don't know what a shot glass is. So he puts it in front of me and he pours in the shot glass and he leaves it there. And I look at this little glass. And I looked around and all the Mormons had tall glasses. Why does he give me such a little glass? Is he trying to punish me because I'm not a Mormon? Or is it because I'm short? You know what I mean? I thought maybe it was in relation to your height. I don't know. But I'm a real, you know, I always try to act macho, you know. So I picked up the little glass and I swallowed the whole thing in one take. And it was awful. It came out of my ears, my eyes, you know, I was crying. So this Mormon that was standing next to me said in Spanish, he must have been a missionary or something, because he said, "Why don't you drink Cuba Libre?" Ah, easy to pronounce. Cuba Libre, por favor. Cuba Libre, Cuba Libre. Rum and Coke. I loved it. I'm addicted to sugar, you know what I mean? I loved the rum and Coke. And from then on, I drank everything but Coke. Scotch and Coke. Vodka and Coke. And finally, I graduated to my drink of choice. Sangria and Coke. Yeah, baby. Ooh, yeah, bring it down. Feeling good. Ooh. Anyway, I began drinking more and more, and I progressed rapidly, you know what I mean? I was just like, I took to drinking like a flea takes to blood, you know what I mean? I just loved it. And I always drank by myself, you know what I mean? It's like people talk about, I didn't go to bars that much, you know, I drank by myself, and I began getting drunk and crawling around my apartment asking God to kill me, you know, and I was just so depressed all the time. And I remember I had my first suicide attempt. I was very dramatic, you know. I was like a male version of Greta Garbo. Leave me alone, please. I want to kill myself, you know. And I remember, I don't know why I had my first suicide attempt. Maybe the doorman didn't say good morning to me, you know, and I'm sensitive. You don't say good morning to me, I'll kill myself. What can I tell you? So I took about 40 pills. It was fabulous. It was so peaceful. It was like a horizontal line coming down, you know. It was so, I don't have to be tall. I don't have to be good looking. I don't have to conquer New York. You know, I don't have to do nothing. It was total surrender. I was dying. But chicken shit that I am, I picked up the phone and talked to my friend Rudy. Rudy's wife had done the same thing, so within 3 minutes he knew what I had done. And he says, Hector, if you don't call me from the hospital, in 5 minutes I called the cops. Click! He hung up. Oh my God! I want to be dead, but I don't want the cops in my house. How embarrassing, you know. So I floated to Bellevue, you know what I mean? And this nurse, you know, this nurse said, honey, what happened to you? And I said, I took 40 pills. Well, that was stupid. What did you do that for? So they pumped my stomach and they forced me to see a shrink, and I began seeing shrinks and more shrinks, and, you know, and I got a deep understanding of my problems. So I guess I was like an alcoholic with deep understanding of my problems, you know, drinking myself to death. You know, I realized something was wrong. You know, I had to change profession. That's what I have to do. And I knew that something was wrong. And I say, I know. If I become an actor, you know, that's a profession where everybody loves you. You know what I mean? And I'm recognized people. I'm going to be okay. You know, and I was going to be the greatest actor who ever lived. I was going to do Richard III better than Olivier in London. That's kind of difficult when you can't speak English, you know. And I thought to myself, if I see myself on TV, I'm going to be okay. And in a commercial, I saw myself in a commercial, and two commercials and three commercials. I still felt like a piece of garbage. Ah, Hector, anybody can do a commercial. Any idiot can do commercials. Even Joe Namath has commercial. No, Hector. You had to do theater, you know. So I got into this play by chance. I got into this play, and this play went to Broadway, and we won all the awards on Broadway. And I remember the first preview when I walked on Broadway, you know. I couldn't say the lines because I was so in awe that this piece of garbage was on a Broadway stage in front of an audience. And I blew the scene, you know. And that was the first preview. And eventually we opened to great reviews, and the play won the award for Best Play of the Year, all the awards. And I still felt like a piece of garbage, you know. And I kept accumulating more things, and I became more depressed, and I had two more suicide attempts. And finally, I was so depressed, I had a moment of clarity. We all have, you know, in our lives. I realized what my problem was. My problem is New York. I had to move to a more loving, caring, nurturing place. So I moved to Hollywood. And, you know, if you're an isolator, you know, you at least in New York, you know, you go down the elevator, you go outside, it's 10,000 people. They're all ready to mug you, but at least they're there, you know what I mean? In New York, everything is 2 miles away. I mean, in L.A., everything is 2 miles away. You have to go to the bathroom, you need a car, you know what I mean? I became more isolated. And I did this TV show and that TV show, you know, and I still kept feeling like a piece of garbage. And one day I had an idea. I know, if I get a Mercedes, I'm going to be okay. And I used to get drunk in sangria and Coca-Cola and go to the Mercedes showroom in Hollywood and cry and ask God to give me a Mercedes. Oh, please, God, give me a Mercedes. That one, the yellow one. Please, God. Oh, I love that Mercedes. Please. And God got pissed off. And he said, okay, you little asshole, I'll show you. And he stole my Mustang. God stole my Mustang. And I went and bought a Mercedes Benz. And I couldn't believe that this piece of garbage had a Mercedes Benz. You know what I mean? I had nobody to visit because I have no friends. I used to go to the supermarket, you know, 2 blocks away, then come back home. I drive around the block, you know, just to use the Mercedes, thinking, I have a Mercedes, hookie hookie, smells like leather, hookie hookie. And then at night I go down to the garage in my pajamas and baby talk to my Mercedes in Spanish. Ay, qué lindo el Mercedito, qué bonito que está, tan lindo. And what's really funny is when I came to AA, I didn't think my life was unmanageable. You know. Anyway, I'm going to get to the bottom because I want to speak about sobriety. I'm a Latino actor, you know what I mean? I've done a lot of television, always playing bad guys. I'm either molesting women, killing people, selling children, pushing dope. I've been handcuffed on TV more times than the Menendez brothers, you know what I mean? So, finally, I get this part in this movie of the week called Wanted, the Sundance Woman. And I get to play a good guy. And I'm going to save the girl. I'm not going to have sex with a girl, you know? I'm going to save the girl. Hey, it's progress, not perfection, you know what I mean? At least I don't get killed or punched, you know? So they give me the part. You know, I play this heavy-duty macho bandido with the bullets, the mustache, the guns, you know, real tough, you know. Pancho Villa's right-hand man. They give me the part, and they forgot. So they call me home and says, Hector, we forgot to ask you, can you ride a horse? Can I ride a horse? You know, I'm a gaucho from Argentina. I was born on a horse. I lied. So we go to a location to Tucson, you know, and we do all the interiors. Now we're going to do the exteriors, you know. We're going to rehearse. We're going to ride around the jail, right, and save Catherine Ross. She was a good girl. And so they put me on top of a horse. Now, if you ride properly, this is a horse. This is you. Nice. What I did, it was like this. Oh, the director didn't think it was funny. He had a heart attack. He said, Hector, why did you lie to us? You told us. I mean, this man on the horse, I'm like a eunuch. He's... Oh, he chewed me out. He said, now you're going to practice. So they put me on top of that stupid animal for 4 hours. I couldn't get off. When I got off, I couldn't get my legs together. You know what I mean? I walked like this. And my ass was a huge blister. So I bought half a gallon of sangria and some Coca-Cola. I went to the motel and, you know, really plastered myself. So I come back the next day. I said to the director, I'm sorry, sir, but I cannot do the take because my ass is a huge blister. Said, Hector, we don't give a shit. Even if you die, you're going to do it. So they put some wet towels on that, what do you call that thing? The saddle, right? And they set me on top of it. Now I'm playing this heavy-duty macho Mexican bandido, right? Sitting with wet towels. And everybody's watching. It was so embarrassing. So they give me the gun, right? And with the blanks and says, Hector, don't cock the gun and shoot only after you're galloping in the air, right? I have a hangover, right? And the way they do it, the six of us principals are lined up, right? And they have the tall guys, the wranglers, the Marlboro guys, holding, you know, the reins of the horse. And when they say action, the wranglers slap the horses in the ass and they take off. Right? I'm terrified. I have a hangover. I look behind me. Ay, ay, ay. It's 50 Mexicans on horses, the extras. I say, if I fall, I'm dead. So I said, I'm going to cock the gun, and at least I'm going to have one shot, right? So I cock the gun, and I go like this, and the horse goes, boom! Oh, my God, I shot the wrangler in the ass. Oh, he didn't think it was funny. He got very upset. So we're going to do a retake, right? And he's holding the horse like this, really far away, right? So but I'm an alcoholic, but I'm not stupid. I cock the gun again. But I'm very bright. I put it next to my leg. And the horse goes, boom. Oh, my God, I shot my leg. The pants are in flames. I don't care. I want to save the girl. You know what I mean? So we run around the jail, and we save the girl. By the time I finish, the whole costume is in flames. So they grab some blankets and put the flames out, and they rush me to the hospital, and... I had a hole about this big on the leg, and they I had to be in the hospital. They flew me to L.A. and I had to be in the hospital for a whole month because it got infected. So I had two operations: one to remove the infection, one for a skin graft. While I was in the hospital, my agent didn't send me flowers, and I'm very sensitive. you don't send me flowers, I'll kill myself. So I asked my friend Irene to bring the pills, and I took 40 of them, or 30, I don't know. And it was my last suicide attempt and my best attempt. I was in coma for 3 days in the intensive care unit. While I was in coma, I had 2 cardiac arrests and pneumonia. I was basically dead for 3 days. That's all my alcoholism took me. I had everything. I had the car. I had the clothes. I had the apartment. I had the view of Hollywood from the balcony. And I had enough money to live a whole year without working. Only one thing was missing. I didn't have Hector. One of you described me when I came here. He said, I was a huge ball of fear covered with a look for human skin. The book says fear is the overwhelming quality of all alcoholics. It equates fear to a thief because it robs us of our lives. Remember the third column in the fourth step? Fear, 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 fear. Anyway, my shrink sent me to AA. He said, Hector, you're an alcoholic. Go to AA. Are you sure, Mike? Yes, I'm sure. Go. And I went to a meeting. It was dark and seedy and ugly. I said, caca, caca, caca. I'm a winner. I don't belong here. And the idiot, my shrink, you know, didn't forget. And 2 weeks later, Hector, did you go to the meeting? He says, no, it was dark and seedy. Ugh, those people are horrible. And he says, there are over 1,000 meetings in L.A. now. Choose another one. Now we have 2,500 meetings in L.A. So I went to another meeting. It was like this, very bright, nice people. And somebody was playing the piano. I said, wow, this looks like a musical comedy. I think I belong here. And I've been sober close to 18 years, and I absolutely adore Alcoholics Anonymous. Thank you. And I call AA the mafia of love. Newcomers, once you come to a few meetings, you can't get out. We are everywhere. Parking lots, Bullocks, the Broadway, the gym. Especially newcomers when you're coming out of the 7-Eleven at 1 o'clock in the morning with a little brown bag. You see one of us. Hi, how are you? We haven't seen your meetings. Anyway, newcomers, stay with us. Nobody wants you anyway. This is the last stop. It's either this or One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. You know what I mean? No, really, stop. Really, stay. Stay, 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 stay. This is the best deal in the world. Let us love you until you learn how to love yourself. Because that's what we do here. That's what we give, is love. That's the purpose of being alive. To love and to be loved. You know. I'm going to talk about the steps in God now in recovery, which is what I like the best. When I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, coming from a Catholic background, I had terrible problem with God. Ay vey, you know what I mean? It was really terrible. My God looked like Charlton Heston, and he acted like Leona Hemsley, you know what I mean? This was not a friendly God. So I had to find a God that really worked for me. And I found this description by Joel Goldsmith that I read a lot besides the big book. And he had this description of God that really helped me. I want to just make something clear. Whatever I say from the podium about God or the steps of the program applies only to me. But this is what I believe, what I practice, and what I teach the people I sponsor. That definition said, regardless of how high my concept of God is, it is wrong. Because it is still a concept. Eventually I have to lose all concepts and reach the consciousness that God is. And then leave the subject alone, because with the mind, I'm never going to know what God is. And the big book says the same thing in a more succinct way on page 46. Even though it was impossible for any of us to fully define or comprehend that power which is God. And on page 53 it says, God is everything or else he is nothing. God either is or he isn't. What was our choice to be? And that's what I believe. That God is. How do I know that God is? Very simply. You have proof of it. You believe in God. You try to do God's will. And not only you stay sober, but you become useful citizens of this society. This room right now is full of walking miracles. Remember, before we came here, we were colossal failures. And look at us now. So God is. And I came to believe, just for me, that God is incomplete without us. He needs us because He loves through us. He needs our hands, our eyes, our hugging, our touching, our kissing, because God loves through us. That's why God says, if you believe in me, I am. I actually believe that we create God. A great theologian, a lady theologian from England, wrote a book that came out like 2 years ago called The History of God. She's a great authority. And he talks about God and how God changed through the thousands of years. Thousands of years, we have like 5-6 different gods. Every religion had like 5-6 different gods. God for war, God for love, God for famine, you know. And eventually all the major religions evolved into one God. It's called monotheism, you know. And she asked certain questions. She says, why is man always longing to have a higher power of God? And it's because we want to give our lives a higher meaning than just this, the material stuff. And she says, God is probably man's most interesting idea. And the big book says the same thing. He says, page 52, our ideas did not work, but the God idea did. And where do I find God? The book tells me. On page 55, we found the great reality deep down within us. In the last analysis, it is only there that He may be found. It was so with us. So that's what I believe. And I believe also that God doesn't do anything to me or for me, but God does everything through me. I'm just a channel through which God can act and show how magnificent He is. Whatever talent I have, whatever ability I have, is not because I went to the Broadway and bought it. It's because God gave it to me. It's His talent. And it's for me to use it properly. For the longest time, another thing that I didn't know is we talk a great deal about God's grace, you know, and meanings of Alcoholics Anonymous. What the hell is God's grace? It's not written in the big book on the 12 and 12. And somebody told me in a meeting once, and that has worked for me, he said, God's grace is an unmerited gift. I haven't done anything to deserve that. It's just mine for the taking. I had just to realize that in my life. It's available to me all the time because my relationship with God is everlasting. You know, from beginning to end. There's no beginning, no end. From everlasting to everlasting. The 12 and 12 on page 32 says, the fact was we really had not clean house so that the grace of God could enter us and expel the obsession. Therefore, we remain self-deceived and so incapable of receiving enough grace to restore us to sanity. Ah, so that's what I have to do. Receive enough of God's grace. How do I do that? Very simply, by working the steps, 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And for the longest time in Alcoholics Anonymous, until my 14th year, I felt the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous was to achieve sobriety. And I came to believe differently. Yes, the end result of working the steps is going to be sobriety. But just for me, the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous are spiritual tools to develop a conscious contact with God. If you notice in the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, the word sobriety is not mentioned. The word recovery is not mentioned. Not even the name of our disease, alcoholism, is mentioned. But there is one word that is mentioned 9 times, check it out, in the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. That word is God. Now I'm going to go very quickly in 5 minutes to the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. The first step says I have a disease. The second step says I need a solution. The third step says that solution is God. I have to turn my will and my life over to the care of God. The book says alcoholism is cunning, baffling, and powerful. But there is one, not two, not three, one. And that one has all power. Not 70% of the power, not 80%. That one has all power. That one is God. And then they, may you find him now. And then they list the steps, you know, to find this higher power. And at the end of the steps, this sentence is, God could and would, not can and will, could and would, if, big if, he was sought. You see, I have to seek God. God knows where I am. He doesn't have to find me. And also, I believe something else. And this may sound like heresy, you know, here in alcohol. God doesn't make anybody sober and doesn't make anybody drink. Because if God makes made us sober and only 10% of the people get sober, what happened to that 90%? He doesn't love them? They are the unchosen? So, but the power of God is available to anybody who wants to use it. If you're willing to go to any lengths. You see, God's love doesn't discriminate. He loves everybody. It's non-personal, really. God loves this person here who has 10 years of sobriety, and he loves the criminal who just killed 5 people. The quality of God, it never alters. It's love. Okay? So if I want that gift, it's a co-creation. God cannot do anything against my unwillingness. If I'm not willing to do it, God loves me so much, he gives me free choice. So now I am a step 4. I had to step 3. I had to turn my will and my life over to the care of God. What is my will? My will is my thoughts. What is my life? My life is my actions. The sum total of my actions. A man or a woman is not judged by what he wears, but what he drives, and how much money he makes. A man or a woman is judged by his actions. Your actions speak so loud, I cannot hear what you say. So now, how do I turn my will and my life over to the care of God? Very simply, by working the rest of the steps. The book says, I am blocked from the sunshine of the Spirit. I am blocked. Those, what are those blockages? Those blockages are my character defects. 4 and 5. So, I have to write them down and share them with God, myself, God, another human being. Right? That's 5. 4 and 5 is the relationship with myself. Then I have to do 6 and 7. I have to go home, look at the list for an hour or so, and then humbly ask God to remove these character defects. And the book says, the most of them will be removed, but some of them I had to be content with improvement. That's why God, but Bill Wilson designed number 10 later on. So now, am I ready to receive God's grace? No, not really. See, when I was drinking, I did all this harm to all of you. That's my relationship. 8 and 9 is my relationship with the world. So I had to make that list. Some of the names come from the 4 and 5. And go and make amends to all those people to keep the channel clean. Am I ready to receive God's grace? Yes, I am. But Bill knew I am an alcoholic. And I'm going to screw up on a daily basis. So he designed number 10. To keep the channel clean. When we were wrong, we promptly admitted it. Okay, so now I develop a modicum of a relationship with a higher power. How can I improve that? How can I make it better? That is step 11, prayer and meditation, which are very ancient tools used by every major religion. What is prayer? Prayer is a dialogue with God. Man always longed for a relationship with a higher power. And prayer is the proper channel. And prayer is not a supplication. It's not a begging. It's not a demanding. It's a tool to align myself with the will of God. And you told me I can have to pray only for God's will and the power to carry that out. Because I cannot tell God I need this and I want this. Then I'm trying to teach him that I know more than he does. And also why I cannot ask for anything, because I don't know what's good for me. I thought having a Mercedes was good for me. Having money was good for me. Having an apartment was good for me. And I got all that and I ended up in coma for 3 days in an intensive care unit. Obviously, I don't know what's good for me. And what do I do after I pray to God? I shut up. That's meditation. Somebody said the highest form of prayer is silence. Silence is the language of God. You see, when I'm blabbering, you know, I cannot hear God. And the reason there are many forms of meditation and none of them is good for everybody, we'll have to find our own. I just close my eyes and sit quietly and I try to go to something. God is love, God is peace, whatever it is I choose. It's called a mantra. And I speak very quiet to hear the still small voice of the kingdom of God which is inside of me. Because I am an extension of the Spirit of the living God. I'm a man, a woman, whatever it is. We're God's greatest creation. You know, and that power is inside of me right now, every single second of my life. And it was with me before I was born. It will be with me after I die. And that's what I believe. But unless I harness that power, unless I am aware that power is there, you know, it's totally useless. It's like thousands of years, you know, electricity was available, but people didn't know how to use it. It's like having the most beautiful lamp, beautifully designed, but unless it's plugged to the source, it cannot shine. So I had to be very quiet to hear that voice. And after I developed some sort of, you know, or spiritual peace or knowledge, what is the purpose of that? Only one, to help you. I can sound like Mother Teresa from the podium, but unless I'm helping somebody, doing some service, my program is worth nothing. The book says, faith without works is dead. And it says it twice. You know, to live is to serve. And if you know, if you really think about it, the people who have changed the world, Jesus, Buddha, Mahatma Gandhi, all the great leaders, they were basically servants. The whole purpose was to serve. Bill Wilson, a man of messiah proportion, a man who really changed the world when he wrote that big book. It's in 140 countries. If you read that magnificent biography, we have passed it on, please read it. You see he dedicated his entire life, you know, to this project, Alcoholics Anonymous. He was a servant, you know. To live is really to serve, you know. And it's wonderful that you love me, but it's infinitely much more important that I love you and do something for you. Because the book says I'm selfish and self-centered. And to get out of that, I had to be centered on you. Anyway, I worked the steps. When I got sober, you know, I went to a meeting every day for the first 2 years. I had at least two or three conventions a week. I read a big book, the 24-hour book. But I would not get a sponsor first year and a half, because he's going to know that I'm a piece of garbage and he's not going to love me. So the first year of my sobriety, somebody told me, this is a true story, that if you have a good sex life, you don't have to work the steps. And I did that. And I stayed sober, but I was tired all the time. And then I became a devotee of the Winchell Donuts Divinity Church. And at night, because I was not working the steps, you know, I would go crazy. So I'd go to Winchell's Donuts and order, you know, 4 apple fritters and 2 chocolate donuts. And I eat them and then go across the street and buy a Diet Coke. And I gained about 40, 50 pounds. And somebody said, Hector and Abe, we turn our will and our lives over to the care of God, not to the care of the refrigerator. And they say, Hector Haagen-Dazs is not a good name for a higher power. So I also went to the other program for food, and I found out that alcohol kills 100,000 people a year. Fat kills 300,000 people a year. Cigarettes kills 400,000 people a year. As a matter of fact, if you read a biography, you'll learn how Bill Wilson, our hero, our messiah, how he died. He died from smoking, you know, emphysema. He couldn't give it up until the very end. This giant, This enormous giant was killed by cigarettes. Anyway, but that's in a different program. Anyway, and we talk only about alcoholism here. And finally I got a sponsor. And I did the steps. And to my great, great surprise, when I told him all the garbage I had done, which was really chicken shit, you know. I was an isolator. I didn't do that. I think the worst thing I did, I stole a raincoat once from Bloomingdale's. And when I went to do the amends, I sent a letter to Bloomingdale's in 1961, 30 years ago or something, I don't know. I said, I stole a raincoat for $175. Please tell me, well, how should I pay you? They never wrote back. Good! I don't have to pay! And my sponsor says, oh, no, 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 Hector. You send the money to AA. Oh, damn it. You know. Anyway, I work the steps, you know, and I do the same thing now that I did when I was new. I'm really a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm not a visitor. I have two commitments. I have a sponsor. I sponsor people. I have a home group. I pray, I meditate, and I do the steps. Not because I am good. It's because I'm a flake. And if I stop going to meetings and doing the things that I can, you know, that I'm supposed to do, I'll drink. I know for sure I'll drink. This is the thing that I've learned in the longest, on a continuous basis for the longest time in my entire life. 17 and a half years. Never before. And that's why I love to do it, because my life has improved. I'm not perfect. I sound like Mother Teresa from the podium, but put me in traffic and I become Charles Manson. You know what I mean? I have character defects, but I'm so much better than when I came in. One of the things that I made amends to, you know, to all the people I was supposed to make amends, but there was something bugging me. Something bugging me. And I realized after 2 years of sobriety, I still hated my parents. And the book says, resentment is the number one killer. And it doesn't exempt our parents. You know, there's one exception. You can have resentment against your parents. And I realized I had to do inventory. And I found out that I acted exactly 14 ways, exactly like my father. That which you hate, you shall become. That which you fight against, you shall become. I didn't know that. And then I realized that we have double standards in Alcoholics Anonymous. If a newcomer walks through that door right now, he says, I just got out of jail. I was in jail because I killed 5 people. You know, I robbed 15 banks. I just got out. Oh, welcome. You're one of us. You want some cookies and coffee? And later on, we'll take you out to dinner. Instant forgiveness. We don't judge here. We don't care what you've done. Not with our parents. They had to be perfect. Are we perfect? I know I'm not. And when I went to the 8th and 9th, I wanted forgiveness. I didn't want justice. If I was going to get justice for all the garbage I did when I was drinking, you don't want to be standing next to me when I get it. So I looked, I made inventory about my mom, and I realized that she changed a few times. And that was wrong. That was child abuse. That was totally wrong. But that was only 20% of the equation. I looked at the other 80%. And she worked at 2 jobs every single day of the year for the first 18 years I was in my house. 2 jobs, 6 o'clock in the morning to 11 o'clock at night. And I remember when I was 5 years old, we didn't have money for a Christmas tree. And she got some crepe paper and some wire and a broomstick. And she made a Christmas tree. 4 branches. 5 branches, 6 branches. She went out with a quarter, and she bought 4 Christmas balls and a point. But guess what? I had my Christmas tree. And every year it got a little bigger, and she would make some ornaments. She was doing the best she could with the tools she had. Oh, yes, yeah, she was not perfect. Neither am I. In sobriety. And when I was 12 years old, she bought me a brand new bicycle. Working at 2 jobs, imported from Italy. Beautiful bicycle. So when I had 2 years sobriety, I sent her a ticket. She had never been on a plane before. She moved from Italy to Argentina, and that's it. So she got on the plane and came to my apartment in LA, and I had a 12 feet tall Christmas tree. Real pine.
decorated in her favorite colors, pink and red. And underneath the Christmas tree, she had 33 presents. 33 presents. We overdo things in AA. And I told my mom how much I loved her. And I told my mom that she is a good mom. And I thanked her for all the things she did for me, buying me books, clothes, sending me to school. I never spoke about the things she did wrong. And I remember once she was talking to my sister Olga in Argentina, and I overheard the conversation, and she said to my sister Olga, you know, I wish, you know what I wish for all the mothers of the world, Hector? I wish that they could have a son like my Hector. No, you know, Olga, what I wish for all the mothers of the world, Olga? And she said, what? I wish that all the mothers of the world could have a son like my Hector. Doesn't get any better than that. My mom died last year. She was 90. And my heart is at peace. I'm clean. I did that. You know. God bless her. You know. But my father was a little more difficult. He moved to Syria many years ago, and he remarried and created a new family. And I hadn't heard from him in a long time. And about 5 years ago, I got a letter from him from Syria. Said, "Hi, son, how are you? I haven't heard from you in such a long time. I wanted to say hello. And by the way, I need some money to pay some taxes. Can you send me some money?" Bastard! He writes to me because he needs money. And then he says something else. "My family here says, if nobody talks to me from the other side of the ocean, I must have done something wrong. And if I did, you know, I apologize. Did you do something wrong?" And I began writing back. And I began listing everything he did wrong. And now I am sober and I don't lie. And this is a long list. And then I made a mistake. I asked an old timer what to do. Never do that. Never do that. She said, "Hector, would you rather be at peace or would you rather be right?" I'd rather be right. I waited 50 years for this. But I'm a people pleaser and I sent a nice letter, and you know, I didn't say nothing. But it was not enough. A few months later, I went to see my shrink, and after two sessions, I went back to my shrink, the one who sent me to AA, and he says, "Hector, you have to go to Syria and spend some time with your father." Syria? Are you crazy? Syria's full of Syrians, you know what I mean? They all look like my father, you know. But I'm a people pleaser, so I call my father. I says, "I'm going to be there in about a month. Please wait for me." And he's sound asleep now on the phone. And when I landed in Damascus, this giant, they used to beat me up. All of a sudden I see him and he's about this tall. This little man with wispy white hair and baggy pants is running towards me. And he grabs me and he kisses me. He's sobbing and he kisses me all over the face. And I'm sobbing with this man I don't really know. Because my daddy never talked to me when I was a kid. He never said, "How you doing today in school, Hector?" Remember, he was illiterate. He never talked to me. And he's grabbing me and kissing me, and I'm sobbing in the middle of the airport there, and he's surrounded by his family, and they're crying. And then he grabs me by the hand like a little kid. He puts me in a taxi and takes me to his hotel in Damascus. And in the hotel, he told me he couldn't sleep for the last 3 days because he was so excited because I was coming. And my brother-in-law told me, no, your father's not senile. That's when you called on the phone. He couldn't talk when you called because so excited you called, he was sobbing so much he couldn't get the words out. So we grabbed the phone away from him and we finished the conversation. But while I was there, I realized my daddy always loved me. I just did not love him. I don't want this illiterate little peasant from Syria. I want Nelson Rockefeller. Property, money, prestige, class. That's what I always aim for, class. No, Hector, this is your daddy. And he just told me how much he loved me. He followed me around like a puppy dog. And he told me his story. See, I never knew his story. He said, His father died when he was 6 months old. His mom was 16 years old when she had him. She never went to school. My daddy never went to school. How is this? And then he left Syria when he was 16 and went to Argentina and married my crazy mother. How is this man going to know how to be a caring, loving, nurturing father? He had no idea. Most of us don't get it at home, but at least we go to school, we get some sort of an idea. He didn't have that opportunity. But he loved me so much, he made me dress in this suit and this very, very, very poor village that he lives. His house is the best one. He has a toilet, not a bathroom, but a toilet. He made me dress in this three-piece suit. He sat me in the living room, put some steak in front of me because it's very expensive in Syria. He made me eat it, and he invited all the villagers from the village to come. Look, this is my son from America. And they all had to shake my hand. All of them. And then a blind person without shoes walked in, a beggar, and they guided his hand to touch my face because he also had to know what my son looks like. That's how proud he was of me. And I put him on tape and I photographed him, you know. And after 8 days I left. And at the airport we were both sobbing because I knew I was not going to see him again. He's 80 something. And I said, Daddy, I love you very, very much. And I'm so proud that you are my daddy. And he just grabbed my face and kissed me and he said, Son, I'm 10 times more proud that you're my son. And this gift here, this gift you made, this visit you made here, is the most beautiful gift in the world. Nobody, no money in the world could have given me a more beautiful gift. Now I can die in peace. And we hugged and sobbed and sobbed and sobbed, and I left. When I came to America, something very subtle had changed. Very subtle. I always looked like a man. I sounded like a man. I acted like a man. I dressed like a man. But inside of me, I was a child. I was a 12-year-old. Because being like a man was being like my daddy. And I hated my daddy. And now when I think about my dad, I smile. And now I know what a real man is. Or a real woman. Is somebody who is at peace with himself. That's what the steps are for, to be at peace, so that God can enter us and we don't have to drink anymore. It doesn't have anything to do with those things out there. That's the world of the many, but this is the world of the one, where the living spirit of God is. This is what really counts. This is where happiness comes from. All those things can add to my happiness, but my happiness comes from my relationship with my higher power that I developed through the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. Anyway, once I went to see a movie called The Elephant Man. It's about this very ugly, deformed person, very ugly. He's like a monster. And he lives on the streets and he eats garbage from the garbage cans and he dresses in rags and he smells awful. And the children throw rocks at him and they chase him. Get away from here, you know. It's like, don't be even near us. And this doctor and this nurse pick him up and bring him to the hospital to study him. And they bathe him. And they put nice clothes on him. And they treat him with love and respect. And the face doesn't change. But you get to know him. And you just like him. You said, yes, I could be his friend. You got to know the child of God inside of him. And some ladies come in the film and talk to them and kind of like them and get interested in them. And I said, wow, that's the story of all of us in Alcoholics Anonymous. We come here, you know, feeling ugly inside and out, so uncomfortable. And the love, the care, the guidance, the support that we get in these meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, little by little, ever so gently, the layers built on fear start coming out, down. Very gently, they come down. And eventually, the most beautiful person in the world emerges, ourselves. You see, God made no mistakes. Everybody sitting here, whether you know it or not, is a child of God. It's an extension of divine love. You know, we just got to get in touch with it. That's what we call it, an inner journey. God is not out there trying to get in. God is in here trying to get out. How do we do that? By working the steps, not drinking, doing service, having a sponsor, and loving other people, getting out of ourselves. The secret is really in loving you. It's wonderful that you love me, but it's infinitely much more important that I love you. I know what I'm loving you. That's why the book says when everything else fails, he doesn't say go out and buy another cashmere sweater. When everything fails, go and find another alcoholic to love and care for him. Anyway, people say Alcoholics Anonymous is so fabulous, so wonderful. Do you know why? Because you are Alcoholics Anonymous. You're so fabulous, so wonderful. You are my teachers. And I want you to keep coming back because I need you. I love you and thank you. Thank you.